from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Insurgent candidates like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have proved formidable threats in the primaries. But in another race, the race for delegates, both candidates are struggling a bit. Trump now says the system is rigged. Voters are angry that the delegate math is not the same thing as the popular vote. Party leaders say these are the rules. This hour, On Point, winning primaries, wrangling delegates, and what about the popular will? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is it fair for Trump to complain now when he's struggling? Is it fair if the popular vote winner isn't the nominee? Later in this hour, we will speak to the campaign director of Democracy Spring, which has organized a sit-in on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. Yesterday, 400 people were arrested as part of that. But first, joining me now from Arlington, Virginia, via Skype, is Kyle Cheney, politics reporter for Politico, covering the race for delegates. You can link to his articles at our website, onpointradio.org. Kyle, thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be here, Tom. Thanks.
And with us from Washington is Laura Brown, program director at the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, expert in the role of delegates, author of Jockeying for the American Presidency. Laura Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Kyle, the din of complaining right now from the Trump camp in particular, but there's plenty from the Sanders corner as well, is suddenly deafening. What's going on?
Well, usually the delegate math is such an afterthought because these nominations are locked up by the middle of the spring, and it's pretty much the conventions end up being a coronation of sorts of the presumptive nominee. But when you have a scenario like we have now, two competitive primaries where nothing is certain yet, especially on the Republican side, people are waking up to the fact that the delegate math is actually how the nomination is decided, and it's not it's entirely a Democratic process. And so all these caucuses and primaries, they matter, but they're just one input for how the delegates make their decisions, and people are getting a real education in how that process works all of a sudden.
Laura Brown, you're following this as well, I know, and you've got a lot of historical perspective on this. In the moment, do you see why Donald Trump and some Sanders supporters are complaining?
Well, I understand why they're complaining, because they're obviously not doing well in what is a difficult process. But the rules have been out there. And let me just correct one thing. This process of delegate selection is not undemocratic. It is really a process whereby each state determines how they would like to select the people who go to the national convention. And those states really mostly do processes by which people meet in precincts, and then they select the delegates who are going to go to the next county-level caucus, and then those people in those county caucuses or conventions select the people who will go to the state meetings, and then at the state meetings, they eventually select the national convention delegates. In other words, really, this process is about being an activist and being a loyalist to your party and really being engaged with your party for years and years in order to, if you will, receive the honor to go to the national convention to represent your geographical area.
I mean, you make it all sound so orderly and logical, but we were listening as the Colorado Republican Party, their convention on Saturday, 600 people ran to be delegates. Each candidate was able to make a 10-second long speech, some pretty colorful moments. It didn't exactly sound like political order incarnate.
The only person better for president of the United States than Ted Cruz would be Jesus Christ, but he is not a natural-born citizen. Vote for me, 346, McQueen. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your pens and vote for number 55, Lawrence Brown, or Jenny Raffey, 424. Jenny Raffey, 424.
That's the mothership calling for Donald Trump. I'm Robert Zubrin. I'm with Never Trump, number 584.
Okay, a little bit of sound out of Colorado. Here was Donald Trump yesterday in upstate New York saying the system is rigged.
Our Republican system is absolutely rigged. It's a phony deal. Now, what do I know? I started running like 9 months ago. Who would have thought I would have been in first place? What do I know? Right? What do I know? But I'm in first place by a lot. Millions and millions of votes. That doesn't count. You notice? Nobody even talks about votes. I have millions of votes more, but I also have hundreds of delegates more. But that's not the same thing to me. I think the vote is the thing that you count.
Laura Brown. All right, Donald Trump, he's having a little trouble on the primary front now, the delegate count front now. He needs 1237 to wrap it up. If it goes beyond a first ballot at the Republican convention in Cleveland, then all of these delegate loyalties are suddenly up for grabs. You can hear right there that he's really worried about this. You know how this works. Describe what's going on, let's say, with the Cruz campaign right now, how they're working to secure delegates, or maybe even to secure the readiness of delegates to come to them on a second or third ballot, if that's what unfolds in Cleveland, Laura.
Well, that's exactly right. What is happening right now is that the Cruz campaign, because they understand politics and because they understand this very long process, I mean, Donald Trump just doesn't realize that part of his problem is that he is running for the nomination of a political party that has existed long before he arrived on the political scene. And so part of what is happening is he is trying to essentially do a hostile takeover of a Republican Party where right now, I mean, not even looking at delegates down the road, but right now the majority of delegates that have been selected do not actually favor Trump. They favor many of the other candidates who did run and are still the few in this race. But I think what you're getting at and what he's upset with is that the Cruz people are identifying their supporters at the local level. They are reaching out to those supporters. They are asking them to run for delegate. And what they are hoping is that when the convention meets and when the first roll call happens and no one receives a majority of the delegates, then those about 60% of the delegates in the Republican side will become unbound. And at that point, you can really then vote and in whatever way you choose. And many of the people are hoping that they will vote for Cruz on that second ballot.
Carl Cheney, Donald Trump complaining a lot about how those delegates' loyalties are being won. I want to ask you about that. But here he was on Monday talking with Fox News, saying it got the popular vote, not the delegate count.
As an example, South Carolina, I won it by a landslide, like a massive landslide, and now they're trying to pick off those delegates one by one. That's not the way democracy is supposed to work. And, you know, they offer them trips, they offer them all sorts of things, and you're allowed to do that. I mean, you're allowed to offer trips, and you can buy all these votes. What kind of a system is this?
Kyle, is that just Donald Trump, you know, shooting off, or how are the loyalties of delegates secured?
Well, Donald Trump probably has the capacity to offer trips himself. He's a few golf courses that he could wine and dine some delegates at. And I think we may start seeing more of that across the board. That is actually a tool that candidates can use. They can pay for travel for delegates. And, yeah, it's a way to woo and to coax, you know, delegates to come into the fold or at least get an audience with them to try to win them over. He's right. This is not a purely democratic process, and maybe the party's mistake has been portraying this as an exclusively democratic process for years because they've never had to use these delegate machinations in the last, you know, four decades or so. In a serious way.
What about on the Democratic side of the ledger? We've heard plenty of complaints from Sanders supporters about the weight of superdelegates in the Hillary Clinton category. Of course, she says, look, I've got the popular vote here, but Sanders has been winning a lot of contests lately. Is there a counterpart to this GOP furor on the Democratic side, Kyle?
It's a little less climactic because the math is so stacked against Bernie Sanders at this point. It's going to be extremely difficult for him to catch her on any part of the, whether it's the superdelegates, you know, or just the general pledge delegate count, and the popular vote. So he has less of a less compelling of a case to make that you know he's being cheated out of this, or that the delegate math is somehow overturning the will of the people. But yeah, it's just, you know, the super delegates, Democrats in particular, have decided that they think their party insiders should have a disproportionate voice in choosing the nominee. And in a case like this, where you could see the super delegates decide the outcome, although probably he'll lose the pledge delegate race too. You know, that those super delegates loom large, and he's been losing them at a very large clip too, dramatically to the Clinton camp.
There's lists of superdelegates up online. It initially went up as a hit list. That's been changed now. But you've got Sanders people lobbying these delegates to come over to Bernie.
And it's a little bit ironic because, you know, these are the party insiders and the party establishment that the Sanders camp is in some ways run against. But now he needs them, and he's trying to convince them that he's actually a better general election candidate than Clinton is. You know, so far he's had limited success with that. You know, made a little few inroads here and there, but he needs hundreds of these people to flock to him. And barring some dramatic collapse of the Clinton campaign, that seems unlikely.
Laura Brown, maybe a little reality check for Americans who have just looked at the primaries and thought, well, okay, it's a kind of a weird hopscotch across the country, but it's essentially the popular will being played out. It's something else, Laura.
Well, it is. I mean, really, this is about who the party wants to be the face of their party in the general election. And so we do have this sense that, gosh, maybe the public should choose the party nominees. But there is another way to think about it, which is, why should a party include those who don't consider themselves partisans actually to be part of the process?
We've got a lot to look at here. This is just getting bigger as this rolls forward toward the nominating conventions this summer. Kyle Chaney is with us, politics reporter for Politico. You can see his articles at our website, onpointradio.org. Laura Brown is with us, author of Jockeying for the American Presidency out of George Washington University. And you can join us. Are you sympathetic to Donald Trump when he says it's rigged? Are you sympathetic to Bernie Sanders, who keeps winning states but is having trouble narrowing that delegate count? Delegates, Republicans, Democrats, are you being lobbied, courted right now, strong-armed, threatened? Bernie Sanders talked with ABC's This Week. This was in late March after winning primaries in Hawaii and Washington and Alaska. There would be more to come here with Sanders.
Clearly, we have the momentum. And I think at the end of the day, we're going to end up with more pledged delegates than Secretary Clinton. And then I think the superdelegates are going to have to make a very difficult decision. And that is, if a candidate wins in a state by 40 or 50 points, who are you going to give your vote to?
Superdelegates have more or less complete leeway on that front. Hillary Clinton, same last month as well, said, well, okay, but let's wait a minute here. I'm the one capturing the popular vote.
You know, I've gotten more votes than anybody running on either side. I've gotten more votes than Donald Trump, although I'm sure he doesn't want to hear that.
And how rough does it get out there? I'm not sure, but here's Paul Manafort, recently stepped in as Trump's convention manager. That could be pretty wild. He talked with Chuck Todd on Meet the Press.
What is fair game to win a delegate? Is threatening a fair game? Is threats a fair game?
It's not my style. It's not Donald Trump's style.
What is?
I'll tell you, it is Ted Cruz's style, and that's going to wear thin very fast.
You think he's threatening delegates?
Well, he's threatening that there. You go to these county conventions, and you see the Gestapo tactics, the scorched earth tactics.
Gestapo tactics?
Yeah, they are.
That's a strong word.
Well, you look at, so we're going to be filing several protests because the reality is they are not playing by the rules.
Kyle, is that just made up hot language or Gestapo tactics, scorched earth? What is actually going on the ground?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the Trump campaign's frustration that they've been so far behind the eight ball in the delegate fight. I mean, they're getting routed in state after state, even states where Donald Trump won the popular vote by a wide margin. Cruz has shown a real prowess at coming in there with organization and connecting with the grassroots, you know, Republican activists who dominate these delegate fights. So, you know, Gestapo tactics, it's clearly a pretty overheated phrase,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I think it really, you know, you could spin that the other way and say superior organization, which is how the Cruz campaign would say it, and they're calling him a sore loser for that kind of language.
I mean, how does it work? Like in Louisiana last month, Trump carried it by a small margin, but I'm reading here Ted Cruz might ultimately win more delegates there in his loss than Trump will in his victory. How does that work?
Well, essentially, you know, they each win a certain number of pledged delegates that are sort of proportional to the vote for the most part. And so those delegates will cast their ballots according to the results on the first ballot. But the identity of those delegates is picked through that separate delegate selection process. And it's picked in different stages at sort of local conventions and at the state convention. And you know, the identity of those delegates, those people don't necessarily have to support Trump, even if they're bound to support Trump on the first ballot, so they can flip over. And so Cruz, again, has been putting his people in slots that are going to go to Trump on the first ballot, but immediately jump to him on the subsequent ballot.
Sort of wrapping up that subsequent ballot scenario. And, Laura, I think you and many others are anticipating a very strong likelihood there will be more than one ballot at the GOP convention.
That's right. I do think there's going to be more than one ballot at the Republican convention. I think one of the things we haven't really addressed, which is going to be what will happen prior to the roll call of the states and when these ballots actually occur. Because at conventions in the past, usually the real contests come in the credentials challenges of delegates or in the rules challenges about who and which delegates can actually vote on what rules. So we're likely to see a lot of pre-roll call of the states maneuvering, and many of those rules end up changing the numbers that end up, you know, being the result of the state's voting.
Let's go to our listeners. Lots of questions and calls on this. Steve in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Steve, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had one simple question of why we have a delegate system instead of just relying on the popular vote. And I'm sure that, you know, Al Gore supporters back in that general election would really like to ask that question. And I'm sure that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders supporters also have this question. But why is it that we have a delegate representative system instead of a popular vote?
Got it. With Al Gore, I mean, you're alluding to Electoral College there, but let's stick with delegates and the primary part of this. Laurel, why? How did this emerge?
Well, quite frankly, our framers never imagined there would be political parties. So this one question about who should choose party nominees was something that was never really settled on. It was never thought about, and this entire system has evolved over time. What we don't seem to realize or appreciate now is that our system is actually more open and, if you will, democratic than it has ever been. This process started where nominees were chosen by a congressional caucus. In other words, each party's congressional delegation chose their presidential nominee. It then moved to national convention delegates who were not bound to any primaries or any other state votes. And then we had reforms basically in the 1970s that did try to bind these convention delegates to the state preference voting. But again, this is not a process that you know, we necessarily or anyone had thought about in toto. And I think more importantly, we should realize that we are actually far more fortunate than most parliamentary systems, because in a parliamentary system, voters never have an opportunity to choose who will be the party's standard bearer as the potential prime minister.
Here's the thing to my mind, though. The parties are saying, look, these are our rules. This is our business. We'll do it the way we like. It's our party. But the public, the government, the public through the government, pays for all this voting. All the voting places, all the polling places, everything that goes into the machinery of actually getting out all these votes we've been reporting on for months, that's public money paying for that. So how can it be both ways? If the party wants it to just be their vote and they just make up the rules, and, you know, why shouldn't they pay for the whole process?
Well, Tom, that's a great question. The Supreme Court has actually deemed political parties quasi-public institutions, sort of meaning that they do public things, but they are allowed to operate under a certain amount of private discretion. And what we actually see is that caucuses and conventions are funded and paid for by state parties. Primaries, on the other hand, are funded by state governments. And we do have this kind of mix of a system. And again, a lot of this has to do with, if you would like to participate, you just simply need to get involved with your party. And you can make a difference in the nominating process if you do so. But the reality is the vast majority of Americans don't vote in primary elections. Turnout is typically only in the 30s.
Let's go to Roger in Nashville. Roger, what do you think about this issue of party decisions but public funding for the voting itself?
Yes. Your speaker just answered one of my questions. I guess I would have to follow up with, why then, if the taxpayers are paying for the primary, why do we not include a third party or an independent party in the primary to where it would be basically a Democrat versus a Republican versus one independent?
Why not open it up? Why leave it a duopoly here? Or, you know, yeah, even more wide open than that. Laura, what do you say?
Well, that is right. And one of the issues that has come about time and again is, how do we encourage third-party competition? Third parties do have higher hurdles to get onto a ballot because they usually have to receive a certain percentage of the vote in the prior election to qualify for a slot on the next ballot. And this is where you can see something like Ross Perot's massive effort to get on the general election ballot in 1992 was really what it took to keep the Reform Party engaged at all the state levels for the next couple cycles. But we now don't have something like that in many states.
Kyle Cheney, Laura watches this over time, over a lot of time, as someone who studies the history of this. When you look at Americans' frustrations, if they're frustrated right now, I mean, can you see why they might be unhappy with this, saying, well, look, you know, come November, we're going to have basically two choices here. And if we don't like the way they were selected, what kind of choice is that?
Well, and I think it's compounded by the fact that so many of Donald Trump's supporters are newcomers to the political process. These are people that, that in many cases, have never voted before, and he touts that as he wears that as a badge of honor that he's bringing in a whole class of voters that are just were not participants in the past. And they're angry with government, and they think he's an outlet and a reflection of their frustration and anger. And so it's no wonder that they're equally frustrated and angry at how this nomination process is unfolding because, you know, a lot of these people have never participated in especially those granular local county conventions and things that party insiders need, you know, use to drive the delegate process. So yeah, I mean it's no wonder that you're seeing that frustration and real, you know, in some cases heated anger from Trump supporters at what they're seeing unfold with the delegates.
Here's after Ted Cruz won all 34 delegates in Colorado's Republican State Convention. This was Saturday. Here's one disgruntled voter there posting a video of himself burning his Republican Party registration.
I quit the party, and for the time being at least, I'll be independent. And I'm voting for Trump, and to hell with the Republican Party.
But you've got party loyalists in here who lined up for Ted Cruz in Colorado, and they say they're solid for him. Here's one, Kendall Unruh, telling CBS earlier this week she'll follow his command.
It's going to take marching orders from him, whether it's casting the first ballot for him or whether it's going to be 10. No one can predict what's going to happen.
Right now, that appears to be quite true. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Roger there. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I find that a lack of knowledge about the rules doesn't mean that you should be able to change the rules. And I mean, it really is kind of embarrassing. It almost seems like Donald Trump would just want an app that everyone could just use on their phone. My question to...
Why would that be embarrassing? Trump, that sounds pretty democratic.
Yeah, but it also is just reflective of a very emotional state that you're in. You know, you could get a message on your phone and you could just say, I don't agree, boop, and then 20 minutes later you'd change it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the thing that I'd want to ask Mr. Trump is, what if we were to reboot everything right now and start over? Do you think you would have as many votes as you claim to have now? Or would you think you would have as much support as you do as you think you have now?
People have learned a lot more about Donald Trump in these months that he's been in the spotlight. For a long time, that worked quite well for him. We're looking at how the delegate scramble is working out right now as it really gets down to brass tacks on the way to the convention. Kyle, what about the Trump operation? I mean, his soaring up to the top of that big pack was more a kind of national media appeal than this ground game that's kicking in so hard right now, Kyle.
Exactly, and I think Trump, you know, I don't know if he confused the fact that he had this groundswell or this movement, in a sense, of support that wasn't really built on a significant or sophisticated operation with, you know, what it takes to win. And I think we're seeing him put together a good team of veteran operatives now. You know, Paul Manafort, who you played a clip of earlier, you know, is one of the best at this. Real Washington insider, who in one sense doesn't really jive with Trump's message as a candidate, but knows how this process works. But the question is it too late now to start building this operation when Cruz has been doing it basically since he got in the race?
Matt in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I was just wondering, I noticed in Colorado that Bernie Sanders won by something like 12 percentage points, but I believe he ended up with less delegates than Hillary, or maybe even. I'm just wondering how that's possible when you won by 12 percentage points.
How does it work, Laura? How does that happen?
Well, you know, I'd have to look up the specifics of Colorado, but what I can tell you is that in many of these states, you know, delegates are apportioned either by congressional district or statewide. And what you actually have in a situation like this is, because I believe Colorado was in a caucus, and so you had essentially people.
Colorado was
had,
a convention. I wonder if Matt was meaning Wyoming, which, perhaps what he's talking about, I think, was caucus. But you know, the
because what you do have in these conventions and caucuses are essentially meetings where they are selecting delegates. And that process can be a little bit different in terms of the delegates who are selected than necessarily the people who vote in the beauty contest or the preference poll. In fact, if you take a look at
you're calling
you remember,
the primary vote a beauty contest, a contest and
well,
a preference
in some
poll.
States,
I mean,
in
people
some,
take it seriously.
Well, no, I'm not saying that it's not serious, but in some states, it is literally considered a beauty contest because those delegates are not bound. We can look at Pennsylvania. There are 54 delegates across their congressional districts that are not bound to any result. So it is important to understand that sometimes the primary result matters. Sometimes it does not. Sometimes the convention process does bind delegates, and other times people can be selected separately. But I just want to bring up one thing quickly, which is that, you know, many people, when they look back to 2008, they thought that Senator Barack Obama was this, you know, political newcomer, and he was jumping into a race, and it was incredibly difficult for him to win against then Senator Hillary Clinton. And one of the things that is true is he sat down with a large number of attorneys. They pored over the delegate rules on the Democratic side. They figured out that he needed to win all of the caucuses and the small states and stay even with Hillary in the big states, and he would then essentially mount a delegate lead. That is what Donald Trump did not do. And that really speaks to his level of seriousness about being engaged in politics. If you want to win, you have to know the rules under which it is played.
Kyle, if Donald Trump's people continue with this theme of rigged, phony, even corrupt floating out there, how does that play out in the convention scenario?
I mean, it's a little scary. It's a little scary in some sense because you do have, you know, again, this class of voters now that are new to the process that are infuriated by this, you know, and you're seeing it, the harsh and hostile reactions across the board. And like Tennessee had a state party meeting a couple of weeks ago, in which they selected delegates that were friendly to Cruz despite Trump's victory there, and they were bombarded. You know, the Trump people were giving out the cell phone numbers of party leaders, and they were getting bombarded with hate. You know, harsh calls. Indianapolis Star was reporting that their delegates, who actually spoke to us for a story, who are opposed to Trump, are getting threats, and the police are investigating. So,
Kyle, hold the thought right there. We've got much more to look at. Kyle Chaney with Political Laura Brown, author of Jockeying for the American Presidency. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the 2016 presidential primary process, the rules, the way it works, the scramble for delegates, and asking, is it fair? Is the people's voice being properly heard? Kyle Chaney is with us, politics reporter for Politico. Laura Brown is here from George Washington University, author of Jockeying for the American Presidency. You can join us. What do you think? Is there a better way to decide our nominees for the presidential contest? What might that be? And how? Would you look at regional primaries or rotate the voting order of states or have a national primary voting day? What about what's going on right now? Neil writes to us on Twitter, says, Trump's just whining as like his followers, like children, because he doesn't understand how the system works. Well, we're all getting a kind of education if you hadn't been paying close attention. Unaka says, I guess I wouldn't mind the argument, this is on Facebook, that these are party rules and they're entitled to make their own rules. If we could have viable third parties or independents, the two parties decide who debates, therefore essentially deciding who we hear from. Laura Brown, what about ideas out there for a different way of selecting the choices that Americans will have in November? People talk about a national primary day or a regional primaries. Describe how those might work and what do you think of them?
Well, there are a lot of plans that have been floated at different points in time. And let me just say that over the course of history, The reality is the system does change when enough people are dissatisfied with the current result. So that was true in 1824 with regard to the King caucus. It was true after 1968 with regard to Hubert Humphrey's nomination. And if there's enough of an outcry, there might be a change. But these proposals really only weigh sort of some benefits and some, you know, downsides. Really, when you look at what the drawbacks of all proposals are, there isn't a good way to choose nominees. The reality is that were we to have a national primary day, yes, everybody would get to have kind of an immediate vote. But one of the things that is also true is that for a candidate to run in every state and to be known in every state prior to a primary, it would cost exorbitant sums of money. And it's very likely that that person would have to already be a celebrity to even mount an appropriate campaign or a one that had a chance. And then you think about rotating regional primaries. And while that might be better than how we do it right now, which is starting off in Iowa and New Hampshire, what you essentially have is a set of different kind of expectations for what becomes a national leader with every campaign, because different regions of the country might bias one type of candidate or another. In other words, there really isn't a good way. People have tried and thought about this. I know one of the things one of my colleagues has suggested is that we should have the parties select a group of five people first and then put those to a vote. So in other words, flip the process, let the elites start it, and let the voters figure out the final.
That, I mean, that would be right at odds with the sort of populist fever that's been in the air in this campaign season, certainly. Kyle, what are you hearing when you're out reporting and talking with voters? How strong do you think this sort of dismay at the delegate system, the primary system as it exists, is in this year when Trump and Sanders have had these big insurgent campaigns, which have been rather successful?
Sure. Well, I think one of the things, and you hear it a little bit among voters, but even among some of the party insiders, is that right now you have a sort of, especially on the Republican side, this mishmash of states where you allow independents or even Democrats in some cases to cross over and vote in the Republican primaries. And that's why when Donald Trump, who has been particularly successful among these independent, maybe sometimes former Democrats, they call them Reagan Democrats, and now a lot of them are either Republicans or independents, they're coming out in droves for him. And in closed primary systems, that wouldn't be possible if they're not registered Republicans. You know, Cruz has done particularly well in states that only allow registered Republicans to vote. So if the party wants more control over its process, you could see more calls to close off primaries in states like New Hampshire and Massachusetts, where independents can vote in either Democratic or Republican primary.
It's kind of amazing, Kyle, how fast Trump went from big head of steam to now, if you read the press on this, people talk about struggling for delegates here and there. And he says, I'm still doing great, but how does it look now, given the way this is actually working and the Cruz ground game sort of lapping Donald Trump every other day here on the delegate accumulation? Does he still have a shot at 1237, which would give him a first ballot victory in Cleveland?
I think the consensus is forming that is going to that's where he has to make his stand. He's got to get that 1237 number on the first ballot. He's in about 750 now in that range. And California and New York, which will obviously vote next week, will be the largest share of delegates left that he could win on a first ballot. And if he does, runs up a large margin in both of those states and holds his own in the other handful that are still to come, he could hit it. It'd be close, but he could hit it.
And what about on the Democratic side? You got Hillary Clinton coming out and now criticizing an online effort by Sanders supporters to cajole, let's say, party superdelegates to the Sanders camp. If there's a scenario for Bernie Sanders here, it's going to involve a bunch of those superdelegates. What about the lobbying going on there? Can you see it becoming intense enough to bring them over, enough of them?
It's hard to envision that. I think you hear Sanders saying, I'm going to overtake Hillary Clinton in pledged delegates before this is all said and done, yeah, not counting those superdelegates. And I think he'd need to do that. And that would be his most compelling argument. It's, again, that seems unlikely. But if he does that, then you can say, hey, look, I'm winning the votes based on the that are based on the people, even if Clinton holds her popular vote lead, he's doing it in more states. Maybe that'll convince some superdelegates to switch sides.
Laura, remind us why the Democrats have so many more superdelegates than the Republicans.
Well, the Democrats have superdelegates because of the Hunt Commission in 1980, which was essentially after watching Jimmy Carter win the nomination in 1976 and then lose in 1980 as an incumbent president. There was a commission that was put together that decided that party insiders and elected officials should have some say in who the nominee is because they wanted to pick a good politician.
And so, as a result, they still have that extra sway there. And these are elected officials and party bigwigs in a pretty heavy number in the Democrats' count, Laura.
Yes, it's over 700.
What do you think as a historian? Do you think we'll end up changing, or do we just keep going at it this way?
I have a hard time imagining that there won't be substantial rule changes after this round of nominations. But that being said, I don't think that we're going to necessarily move towards something that's like a national primary day, even if there is an outcry from some of those independents. I do agree with your caller who essentially said that, you know, because there's no independent party, it leaves you somewhat stuck in this process. And I do think that that's the hard part. You know, the real question is if we had a more viable third party, which our system in many ways precludes, you'd have more people happy with how this would work out.
Kyle, if there were big rule changes after this campaign season, do you think they'd make it more open or less? Maybe they tried to tighten it up so they didn't get into this situation in the first place.
I have a hard time seeing the parties wanting to give up more control. You know, when you have the Iowa, New Hampshire-based system where that essentially thrust Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders into contention, one guy who was not really associated with the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, and Donald Trump, a newcomer who, has had Democratic positions on a lot of issues over the years. I think you're going to see the party want to centralize control a little more rather than give it up.
A lot of Americans paying close attention this time. Very grateful to the two of you for helping us take a closer look. Kyle Cheney at Politico. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kyle.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And Laura Brown, Program Director at the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Laura, you're terrific. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, 400 protesters arrested in front of the Capitol in Washington. This is On Point. More than 400 peaceful protesters who were part of a Democracy Spring rally against money in politics and restrictive voting rights laws were arrested in Washington, the Capitol, on Monday. Protesters had gathered in Philadelphia on April 2nd and marched 140 miles to Washington. It's been a while since we've seen that many arrests in one day in Washington. We wanted to get a better sense of who's out there and what they're thinking, what they're asking for. Joining me now to look at the protests is Kai Newkirk, Campaign Director of Democracy Spring. Kai Newkirk, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So who organized Democracy Spring? What's it all about?
The coalition of almost 140 organizations from across the spectrum of progressive movements and even beyond, who are united by a clear understanding that our democracy is in crisis, that the corruption of big money in our politics and the outrageous attacks on the right to vote are giving us a government that, far from being of, by, and for the people, is really a tool of the 1% to enrich and empower themselves at the expense of everyone else. And we say this is not a situation that we can continue to tolerate. When there are solutions on the table that Congress could enact right now to protect the right to vote, that could enact right now to end this corruption of big money in politics and ensure that we have an equal voice in our government and our democracy, which we believe is our birthright as Americans, and they refused to lift a finger to do anything, that we have to draw a line in the sand and say no more. And so we are walking humbly in the tradition of nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience, which has been essential to progress in our country through the decades, and carrying this power to the doorstep of our democracy and saying, to Congress, you have to make a choice. You're either going to listen to the vast majority of the American people, progressive, conservative, independent, who want big money out of politics, who want to make sure that everyone has access to the ballot. You're either going to have to listen to us and do your job and fix this broken system, or you're going to have to send hundreds of patriotic Americans to jail day after day simply for demanding an equal voice in our democracy. And we think by confronting this crisis in this bold way, that we can shine a spotlight on it in the middle of this election and rally the American public to our side and make candidates for office from president to city council have to choose a side, that of the people and democracy or that of big money and corruption. And we started that.
Here's the sound of a little bit, Kai, on Monday. I'm sure you were right in the thick of it, but here's the sound of democracy spring.
Money out! Money out!
Money out of politics, one person, one vote. So this is a week-long thing, or how long are you going to keep it going?
We'll see. At least a week. As you said, we started in Philadelphia at the Liberty Bell, 10-day march, 140 miles. Over 120 people from at least 33 states across the union participated and walked the entire thing. Many more joined us for a stretch. And over 400 people arrested that first day. Capitol Police said it was the largest civil disobedience act at the United States Capitol that they were aware of in history.
Kai, you said progressive, conservative, independent.
That's right.
But this, what it looks sort of like what Bernie Sanders has, one way or another, suggested might be some of his leverage. If he were to be president, you know, they would call on people to support him for this political revolution. Is this primarily a Sanders supporter thrust?
It's the nonpartisan independent campaign and movement. There are many Bernie supporters that are part of it. There are Hillary supporters I've talked to. There's even a couple Trump folks. John Pudner from a conservative organization, Take Back Our Republic, marched with us along the route from Philly to D.C. And people coming together from all walks of life, because this is something that the vast majority of the American people agree on. And what we're doing is we're saying, we have to take it to the next level. We have to disrupt business as usual and disrupt the status quo and demand change, right? And I think that's what we're doing. 85 elders, seniors, were arrested yesterday. So focus on lifting up their voices. Today is a focus on racial justice and centering Black lives within this fight for democracy. The next day, focus on labor, workers, youth and students. On Friday, climate environmentalists. On Saturday, we're going to continue into the Democracy Awakening mobilization this weekend with a huge rally on Sunday and then more civil disobedience on Monday. And we will continue until Congress does something to save our democracy. There's four different bills we're pointing to that could also confirm a justice of the Supreme Court who will vote to uphold political equality. We'll continue until they do something to save our democracy, or they send so many of us to jail that it will be the largest civil disobedience of this century in our country. And it's a message that no one can ignore.
What would you like to see passed?
There's four different bills that are on the table right now that would make substantial progress towards a democracy for all. The Voting Rights Advancement Act would restore the Voting Rights Act that was gutted by the Supreme Court and stop these voter suppression laws around the country from moving forward. The Voter Empowerment Act would take positive steps to increase access and make it easier for people to vote. Government by the People Act would institute citizen or public financing of our elections so you can run for office without having to raise money from and to be dependent on billionaires and the 1%. And the Democracy for All Amendment would overturn Citizens United's amendment to the Constitution that would enable us to get rid of super PACs and these dark money groups and say no to billionaires and corporations that want to drop tens of millions of dollars to silence the voices of others in our elections. Congress could move on these things right now. We're saying it's not acceptable for you not to act. If you got a better idea, put it on the table. But if you're going to do nothing, you're going to have to send hundreds of us to jail and expose your commitment in defense of this corruption.
You had 400 arrested in one day just yesterday. How many do you think would have to march and or be arrested to begin to get this agenda enacted? I mean, that is a tall order, and I'm sure you know it.
Yes. Well, I think if we can do something that sends an unprecedented message, right? It has been decades since what we believe ultimately there will be well over 1,000 or 1,500 people that have been arrested over the course of this time, more than have come together and made this kind of sacrifice on any other issue for a long time. And I think it sends a message that the American people will not stand for this any longer. And we will win whether Congress takes action now or if they send us all to jail, because it's going to shine a spotlight on this issue, Tom. It's going to lift it up into the heart of this election narrative and send a message that there will be a growing political price to pay for anyone who defends the corrupt status quo rather than joining with the people to save our democracy.
Kai Newkirk.
Election a referendum.
Kai, we've got it. Kai Newkirk, campaign director of Democracy Spring. They had 400 arrested yesterday and more arrests and more to come. Joining us today from Washington, I don't know what to wish you to stay in or out of jail. I'm not sure where you want to be, but we certainly hear the sound and the message coming from your people, and I appreciate you joining us today, Kai.
Thank you so much. Join us.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.